You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, I'm joined by British ghost hunter and historian Richard Felix. Richard is someone who I've wanted to talk to for a long time and is well known in the UK, primarily for his role as resident historian on Most Haunted until 2009 and his numerous TV appearances. With hundreds of investigations under his belt, Richard has visited some of the UK and Ireland's most notorious hauntings, from castles to hospitals and even haunted battlefields. As the owner of Derby Jail and the host of regular ghost walks in Derby, Richard is knee-deep in the paranormal, so we discuss Bonnie Prince Charlie, Mary Queen of Scots, haunted battlefields, some of England's wonderful screaming skull stories, and a couple of notable hauntings. Richard's love of the paranormal is only matched by his knowledge of history, so I hope you enjoy our chat. As always, you can subscribe to our channel on YouTube under Mysteries and Monsters, which you can also find us under on Facebook. We're on Instagram and Twitter as Mystery Monsters, and you can support the show via our Patreon link in this week's show notes. All the links to the cases that myself and Richard discuss are in this week's show notes, so you can find out more about any of the cases we discuss today. So let's join Richard Felix to discuss some of England's most peculiar haunted legends. This week, I am delighted to be joined by one of Britain's most notable ghost hunters, Richard Felix. With an extensive knowledge of hundreds of alleged haunted locations, Richard's love of the paranormal is only matched by his love of history. Richard, I am delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we?
It's a pleasure. I'm very well, thank you. I'm great. I'm still enjoying lockdown, which I know a lot of people aren't, but I am.
Yeah, well, it's certainly been an interesting year, if nothing else, Richard.
Ooh, yeah, just a bit. Yeah, but I mean, for me, it's just really very nice not to be out probably four nights a week, drudging around the streets of Derby and various other places doing ghost walks and staying up till 3 o'clock in the morning doing ghost walks. much as I enjoy it, it's ever so nice to have a break from it. It really is.
Absolutely, because it's pretty full on. Because, like I say, you're one of the people in the UK who's extremely notable, Richard, in regards to your love of the paranormal and being as deeply involved in it as you. Are. So, as I touched on in the introduction, you've also got a wonderful love of history, because I know you were partly or mostly responsible for bringing of a statue of Bonnie Prince Charlie to Derby, I believe.
Absolutely, yeah. Oh God, yeah. I mean, it's a multifunctional. Yeah, I mean, history's always been my military history, to be quite honest with you. Mm. Although, you know, I was the only subject I was any good at school. School was history, to be quite honest with you. I hated school. Loads every minute of it. Yeah. But history, I quite enjoyed, to be honest with you. But yeah, military history has always been my passion. And anything and everything, really. I'm into disasters. Yes. Big time. I suppose you could say Bonnie Prince Charlie was a disaster.
Yes.
no doubt about that. Plus the Charge of the Light Brigade, the Titanic, the Battle of Isandlwana, the Zulus and the Alamo, and Custer's Last Stand, all that sort of stuff. There's something, I don't know, it says something about me. I'm not sure what. But yeah, I was chairman. All this ghost business actually started, well, I mean, probably most people know, I've always been frightened of ghosts. What the hell am I doing this for? Right from the age of sort of four, I've been not frightened, terrified. It was the word then, as a child. So I've always been interested, I suppose, in something that frightens me.
Mm.
But it all came about because I became chairman of Derby Tourism.
Yes.
And people laugh at that, you know, Derby. And one of the days that Derby actually entered into the, what's the word, the history books, big time, was the fact that, you know, Bonnie Prince Charlie reached Derby and turned back at Derby. You know, a turning point in history.
Mm.
Big time. So I thought, well, there isn't a statue anywhere in the world of the lad that was born to be king. Speed Bonnie Boat, Over the Sea to Sky, Charlie is My Darling, Hundred Piper. It's all, you know, all but more songs written about him than probably anybody else. He's appeared on more biscuit tins than anybody else.
Yes.
And so, you know, I thought, well, this is a very important thing for what happened at Derby.
Mm.
So I raised £100,000 for this magnificent equestrian statue of Bonnie Prince Charlie. And it's worked, you know. I mean, it now appears on the front cover of books and TV programmes. So, you know, in a small way, it's become a mini tourist attraction.
Mm.
And then every year we have a parade through the streets of Derby with the Drambuie Pipe Band and a battle that never really happened between Scots and England. You know, it's all good stuff, you know. I love it.
As you mentioned there, history was the one thing I loved at school as well. I do find it very peculiar, I think, that most people just don't realise just how far down England Bonnie Prince Charlie got.
No, you're so right. I mean, number one, it is a fascinating story.
Mm.
He came all the way from Rome via Scotland and all the way down, traversing five counties in succession without seeing the face of one enemy, and arrived in the heart of England, the centre of England, with only 126 miles still to go to victory, taking the throne, the crown, and London, and the country.
Yes.
And it all crumbled at Derby, unfortunately.
Mm.
And so he marched all the way back again, defeated two more government armies in defeat on the way back.
Yeah.
And lost the last one, of course, you know, the Battle of Culloden. It's a fascinating story, it really is. One day I'll write the book called Decision at Derby. I might not live long enough.
Well, yeah, Culloden is a very strange place, Richard, because I'm
isn't
someone that
it?
Loves the paranormal. And about 15, 16 years ago, I did a wonderful tour of Scotland where we just basically went around the whole area, stopping at B&Bs every other day. So we did Loch Ness and things like that. And Culloden is one of those strange places in my life because I'm someone that grew up in a haunted house. So that's where my love of the paranormal comes from, Richard. So, Culloden is one of those places where I have never felt more uncomfortable in somewhere than I had when I stayed at Culloden. We were supposed to stay for two nights, and I couldn't stay another night. And I wasn't frightened.
Oh, really?
I just felt very, very, very uncomfortable. It's one of the strangest sensations I've ever come across, Richard. I can't explain it.
Wow.
It just felt very oppressive, and I felt very claustrophobic. I just didn't enjoy it. It was very odd.
Yeah, well, I'm going to turn into interviewing you now. I mean, did you stay on the battlefield, or did you stay in a B&B in the you know what I mean? Where did you stay?
There's the tourist centre with they've got like an offshoot of it where you can actually rent a room. And we stayed sort of smack in the middle of it. I'd done the sort of wandering around in the daytime in the hills and everything and following around. Because, like I say, I loved a bit of history and anything like that. I was fascinated by it. But as soon as... I mean, it was a glorious day, wonderful weather. It was when we had that famous heat wave in 2003. So Scotland was very, very warm and pleasant. And other than avoiding the midges, we were all right, Richard.
Yeah.
So it was very strange. I've never had that kind of experience in... Because I've visited battlefields and I've been to other alleged haunted locations. I've never felt that negatively about an area in my life.
Wow. Because I actually spent three nights on the battlefield, on the field to the English, in a tent, dressed as a Highland soldier for a film called Culloden, The Last Highland Charge.
Mm.
And we actually slept on the graves of the English government troops were held. That's quite, and it was, funnily enough, it was 21st June, summer solstice.
Yeah.
And our piper went away without us knowing, and it was 12 o'clock. We heard the skirl of the pipes playing, and we thought, anyway, it was him standing on a mound.
Yes.
That was eerie.
That was
deadly. But yeah, there's something about it. But when you think of the emotion, the death, the trauma that went on, this is because I'm into, as you can probably well imagine, haunted battlefields big time.
Yes.
You know, there's a TV program there, but I've been working on it for years, but. The trouble is, you know, TV only wants scary stuff.
Yes, yes.
And it's not all necessarily scary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, especially living in the UK, we've got notable famous battlefields up and down the country in England, Scotland, and Wales. You know, even if you just look at what happened during the Civil War.
Naseby. Grimsby and Edge Hill. I mean, there's a famous ghost story, isn't there? Edge Hill with us.
Is that the one?
The battle being reported in the sky.
Is that, I was going to say, is Edge Hill the one where the Cavaliers had allegedly seen the reenactment in the sky and King Charles sent some people to check it out?
And they saw it as well, and they recognised, this is big time with what my theories are, they recognised images of officers that were still alive.
Mm.
Because the whole thing was a recording.
Yeah.
Which I believe, I'm getting onto it now, I believe that something like 60% of ghosts are a recording held either in the fabric of the building or in the... in the soil, in the clay, in the water, and especially if a battle's fought in an electric storm, which some are, and Edge Hill was.
Yeah, I remember reading, I think it was Peter Underwood I first read that, and I think one of his wonderful collections of ghost stories, which are numerous, I think he did a chapter on alleged haunted battlefields, Richard, and that was the first time I'd ever seen it, and I just thought, because you'd got that sort of secondary witness and the fact that they could recognise former colleagues and colleagues that were still with us, it's a very strange story.
Isn't it? But makes the whole thing so much more real. And that's where I come in, because that's me. Because basically, I am, for want of a better word, the voice of reality.
Yes,
I'm the bloke that poo-poos the scare factor and tries. Well, you know, the profession of a ghost isn't to get you. They weren't put there to get you at 3 o'clock in the morning, stood at the foot of the bed with chains and dangling from their arms, going, "Woo!" That's great. We love it. Absolutely. But we also love nursery rhymes and fairy stories. Mm. Yeah. But they're fabulous. But that's not what it's about.
Mm.
There's a reality behind it.
Yeah.
And that's where I come in. That's what I'm trying to put a realistic approach on the whole damn ghost business, which, for some strange reason, well, certainly TV-wise, they're not interested in that.
Yeah.
They're just interested in, oh, my God, I'm so scared. Mm. You know, these stones are flying towards me and I've been scratched and pushed over and, of course we are. Anyway,
I mean, is it because of your love of history, Richard, and your ability to know your history, and do you think that's kind of given you a bit more of an insight in regards to the world of the paranormal, because there is such an intrinsic link between both, it would seem?
Yes, there is. The two have to go together. Ghosts and history go together. You can't have one without the other. You know, I mean, I've been doing ghost walks around Derby, York, Ashbourne, Leicester, Chester for 28 years. You're not even funny, but you know. And we're out for 3 hours as well, because you go into a pub, you go into a haunted attic, we have a sort of candlelit supper at the end of the night. The whole thing's a night out, rather than just a quick tourist. But I'm not being funny, but if I just kept saying, there's a ghost in there, and there's a grey lady in there, and there's a green lady over there, and there's a pink lady there, and, oh, God, you'd be bored off your truck. But if you went into the detail of who the ghost was, why it's still there, what happened to it that caught it, kept it still there? You know what I mean? Because it shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
It should have gone to wherever all ghosties go to.
Yes.
Yeah, this is the big one, you see. So, you know, and then you go into the history of it and you find out more of the history of why the ghost is still there. All of a sudden, the whole damn thing becomes fascinating.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about.
One of the unsung reasons for investigating ghosts for me, Richard, because like you say, I think it's a lot of the time people just aren't interested in the historical aspects of certain venues and certain homes up and down the United Kingdom, and probably around the world as well, Richard. And I think, as you've touched on there, if you just hear about, it's usually, when you hear these stories, it's a lovelorn woman who threw herself from a balcony. But I don't want to know that. I want to know who they were. When did they live there? How long has this been going on? It's those kind of things.
Find a name.
Yes.
Yeah. Find the name of. Look back into the history of the building and see if you can. You can never prove the ghost. You can only prove the history behind it.
Mm.
And that's the big one. There is no proof. No proof. There's no proof that ghosts exist. But there is proof of what happened that could cause the ghost.
Mm.
And if you can tie a name down to it, And that's what I tend to try and do.
Yes.
Because they were you and me once.
Mm.
They were human.
Mm.
Some of them still think they are.
Mm.
I think, I'll be honest with you, I think that the reality behind ghosts, and I keep using the word ghost, is actually more fascinating in the long run than the scare factor that we get all the time on every film, be it Paranormal Activity 1, 2, 3, 4, The Exorcist. Or,
yeah.
You know, it's all... I tell you what, the only one that I don't think was particularly scary and I thought was fascinating was The Others.
Yes.
That was, and Sixth Sense, to a certain extent.
Mm. Yes, very true.
They weren't necessarily designed to be a scary ghost film. People weren't being dragged out of bed and, you know, things coming out of the television and that sort of stuff. People being dragged through this vortex and, you know, that's the difference. And they're the ones that I thought were... And, of course, the other one, I think, I thought was Ghost.
Mm.
That was closer to reality than most films have ever been.
Yeah.
Even though it was fabulous and comical and, you know, but it was quite close to the truth, I think.
I think that's often that, as you refer to there, it seems that everything's now got the scare factor and we seem to have completely gone away from where we were sort of 30 or 40 years ago, where people like Peter Underwood would just collate these wonderful collections of stories from around the country, wouldn't they? And you would just think these stories become part
absolutely.
Of the folklore.
Yeah, and Michael Aspel, Strange But True.
Yes, yeah,
fantastic
great series.
Program.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And some of them were quite, a bit scary. Well, you know what I mean? Not necessarily meant to be, but were.
Mm. Yeah.
Because, but it was great, and that's what's missing now. I'm sorry to say, that's what's missing. We need a reality check on it, that, you know, while TV are getting the ratings they do from the scare factor, then I don't blame them for pursuing it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Clearly there is some kind of result for them to continue down this vein, Richard.
Yes, of course there is. We love to be scared. That's why we go to theme parks.
Yes.
We don't go on the ride that goes round and round and round at ground level.
Yeah.
We go to the one that takes us up in the air and our heart ends up in our mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Otherwise, there'd be a queue round the block for the teacup ride, I would suggest, Richard, rather than the roller coaster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're so right. Yeah, it's true, isn't it?
So, I mean, one of the other aspects I've always found fascinating about yourself is obviously your love affair with Derby Jail. So, what dragged you towards, because I believe it was essentially dilapidated and abandoned by the time it caught your attention, Richard. Was this something about being proud of Derby and bringing it back?
I mean, basically, without me knocking Derby and Derby City Council and successive city councils, we are morons in the city of Derby. We have destroyed more. We destroyed the building that Bonnie Prince Charlie made the decision. Well, he didn't, you know, turn back in. We destroyed the building that Mary Queen of Scots stayed in before she was tried and executed.
Mm.
We are morons, I'm afraid.
Mm.
And Derby Jail has a pedigree second to none as regards its history. Most of it was destroyed because it was closed down in 1840, and the whole building, other than the dungeons, was converted into houses. And so there is no trace whatsoever up above, but down below in what luckily became the cellars.
Yeah.
Of the houses above are preserved, or were preserved to a certain extent, but the part I've got was successive nightclubs over the years.
Mm.
It was originally Judge Jeffrey's, appropriate.
Yeah.
Then it was JP's, Jenny's Place.
Mm.
Part of it before that was the Secret Place. And of course it was very badly treated.
Mm.
Ripped apart, doors destroyed. I had a guy, the day I opened, I had a guy come in to the jail who said he had a mate that was one of the builders, and they were ripping the original doors from 1756 from their, whatever you call them, the fixings, and stuffing them down the side of the skips.
Oh.
And there was graffiti all over the doors of prisoners.
Mm.
And he rescued one, luckily, and still got it.
Yeah.
That's not true. He told me his mate rescued one. But I know now, I'm convinced it was the bloke that had it.
Yes.
He showed me a photograph of it. And it got across it, got a famous highwayman that was hanged at Derby Jail. He'd written his name across the bloody thing.
Yeah.
Never got it. Never got it. But at least he saved it. But I've got 9, I think, original doors, full of graffiti. And we had to put it all back to what it was. Rebrick the doorways, brick up the holes from one cell to the other cell to the other cell, sandblast the walls and the floors, and I've got it, turned it back as much as I could to Derby Jail 1756, with, I think, it was 60 people executed from or in front of the building, and two suicides I know of. But trust me, there were an awful lot more suicides took place and murders that took place in the building. And basically, I was doing ghost walks. This is 21. I've been doing ghost walks 28 years. This was 21 years ago. And I used to take people in to the club. I used to give them some 10 or 20 quid, let me in.
Yeah.
And then they'd sell beer to people. The people would buy it and we'd show them what was there and tell them some of the ghost stories, because it was notoriously haunted. And then I got a phone call from the lady that she didn't own it, she rented it, asking if I'd like to buy the doors. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't understand. She said, well, I'm going bankrupt and I'm doing a moonlight, going to Spain. And I've got a dealer in Birmingham that will buy all the doors off me for £100 each. Would you like them? And I said, you can't do this. This is a grade 2 listed building. Well, if you don't have them, they will. And so I rang up the authorities, whoever, whatever, and had the building sealed off. Then it was used by the bouncers big time, very late at night. They after they'd finished, for want of a better word, bouncing, they'd come and drink in the jail. And they were going to turn it into a strip club. And I thought, this can't happen. This is not fair. So I thought, well, I need to take it. So I took it over and converted it back into a small part of Derby Jail 1756. And it's famous, I suppose is the word.
Yeah.
Appeared twice on Most Haunted. And God knows how many other TV over the years.
Yeah.
Ghost Detectives, Scariest Places on Earth, Great British Ghosts, all sorts of stuff. But yeah, it's got an incredible history behind it, and it really genuinely, I'm a huge skeptic, by the way, that believes in ghosts. But I've seen a ghost in Derby Jail at 3:20 on a Friday afternoon. Broad daylight. And lots of people have God, nobody goes away disappointed. Really mean that. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I remember seeing it on Great British Ghosts, which I thought was a cracking little series with Michaela Strachan.
It good? Because, you see, there was no scare factor.
Absolutely, and it was just, essentially, she was going to certain venues up and down the UK, Richard, and just diving into the history of the building. And I know she did a whole episode with yourself and your son.
In
regards to that, and it was fascinating because I believe you've got one of the cells is a former debtor's prison as well, isn't it?
That's right, part of the debtor, because you see, people were put in leaving those days were put in prison if they owed money. Well, how the hell are you going to pay your debt?
Precisely.
Anyway, most of them didn't, and I presume died in there or committed suicide in there. But yeah, and there's an incredible inscription across one of the doors. It says J. Taylor from Measham, which is in Leicestershire, for a £10 debt, 1807.
Yeah.
Beautiful script handwriting. Joined up.
Yeah, and £10 was a lot of money in those days as well,
Richard. In 1807, it was. I mean, I presume J. Taylor never left the building.
Sadly.
You never know.
Yeah.
But honestly, the graffiti on the doors is another one from J. Poole, who was a doctor. J. Poole, June the 8th, 1808, a year later, and all it says underneath it, in good for pure love. Don't know what he did. Doctor, it was both, sure.
Yeah.
But, there's some incredible stuff. It really is.
It is strange, Richard, because I was very fortunate. We had a folklore conference here in Sheffield last year.
Right.
And we had a gentleman who came up, one of those wonderful, eloquent, intelligent, articulate people who loves the weird and the horrifying. And he did a wonderful presentation on Dracula, because the first performance of Dracula outside of London in the UK was actually in Derby.
There it was.
And at the theatre, I believe. Yeah, and which it was wonderful, because he'd ended up going down there. And I believe, whether it's still open or not, Richard, I'm sure you'll be able to tell me more than anyone.
Yeah.
It got turned into an adults only indoor golf club called the House of Holes, which struck me as a very peculiar end to a beautiful building with once again with a haunted history, because I know there are certain strange things that are alleged to go on there still.
Right, now that doesn't mean a thing to me, by the way, because as far the last I heard, I mean, it was for many, many years. It was the Grand Theatre.
Yes.
In Derby, and then it burnt down, and people were killed, which they believe one of the ghosts is the carpenter that still haunts it. But then, for many, many, many years, it became the Locarno, which was a club dance hall type thing. Yeah. And as far as I know, perhaps I'm wrong, it became a one of these multi-Chinese restaurant-y type thing then.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think it is now.
Yeah, he'd gone last year, and he'd taken pictures inside of it, and it's a very strange place, Richard. Yeah, I'll send you a link to it, because it's an adults-only indoor golf club now.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'll send you a link on email later.
Yeah,
Richard.
I didn't know that. But yeah, the almost the world premiere of the play Dracula performed in Derby, and of course we obviously, like many other places, also had the Black Death.
Yes.
In Derby, big time in 1349, and that's where the undead comes from. One of the symptoms being a coma before death.
Yes.
A longer one afterwards, of course.
Yes. and
people actually, you know, the living dead, people actually clawing their way out of their shallow graves, or pushing the lids of coffins open.
Yeah.
And we actually did, I mean, this fascinating bit, this, we actually have a genuine account of a guy who I knew very well, who used to work with me in the Heritage Centre that I opened in Derby. And he was superintendent of drainage, but also of demolition in Derby. And he was responsible for the demolition of a church right next to a place called Dead Man's Lane, which was from the plague pit of 1349. And the church was called St. James the Less. And they were digging graves out, obviously, digging the graves again. And it was a Hi-Mac in those days rather than a JCB. Mm. And it dug out this coffin, and it fell off the bucket of the coffin and smashed, or part of it smashed, bones strewn around. Mm. One of the workmen picked the lid of the coffin up, and there were claw marks on the inside of the lid.
Oh, how awful.
Now, genuine, real, you can tell, fingernail marks on the inside of the lid. Gee whiz.
Yes. Not a situation you want to find yourself in at all, Richard, that.
Not really. No, I don't think so. quite something. So, yeah, we have a good history in the city of Derby, I tell you.
Yeah.
We just need to realise it and do something about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think Derby's not alone in that, Richard, because Sheffield's very similar, because we had a castle here that we built a market on, and it's only in the last sort of five years that they've decided to go back to it, because as you touched on when you were talking about Derby, until I was made aware of it, I was not aware that there was a tower in an area of Sheffield called the manor where Mary Queen of Scots was held, which is still there.
I've been frequently. Yeah. Yeah. I used to do three different Mary Queen of Scots tours, bus tours, and one of them was part of it was to Sheffield Manor.
Yeah.
Into the tower. Yeah. But of course we could never touch Sheffield Castle, where she was imprisoned for a long time, because there's no left, is there? It's all under the market hall, isn't it, or something?
Well, it was. This is the thing, because they've levelled the entire market, and they've got a team of archaeologists in there now, and they're basically revealing it all, Richard. So it sounds as though the city's finally begun to sort of embrace its history, which I'm delighted to see.
I must come and have a look. That's a very interesting. Because I couldn't do that. So you can actually see see
yes.
parts of the foundation.
Yeah, they're uncovering it as we go, because as far as I was aware, there used to be if you knew somebody who worked at the market, that you could, you know, drop them a couple of quid, Richard, and they'd take you into the basement, into a door, and there used to be some remaining foundations that you could go and have a look at, which was basically like one of those inside secrets that if you knew the right people, you could have a look at it.
What a shame I didn't.
Yeah. But you'll be able to see more of it now.
too right. But, I mean, are they planning on preserving it and keeping it, or are they going to put a Marks and Spencers on top of it?
It's part of a whole redevelopment, and that's one of the central pieces of it, is to basically embrace its history and reveal Sheffield Castle.
And keep it open to the public?
Yes.
Oh, boy. Well done, Sheffield.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic.
Because it's very interesting, because as you touch on, and as you mentioned there about the plague, the thing about where we live, Richard, because we're essentially not very far away from each other, we've got a lot of...
No, we're not.
Things in common. Miles, yeah, because obviously one of my favourite places to visit in the locality is obviously Eames, synonymous with the plague as well. Yeah, and that's one of those places that when anybody ever asks me about somewhere historical you can just go for a wander around, that is both a heartbreaking and inspiring piece of history literally on our doorsteps.
Yeah, indeed. Because we share the Peak District, don't we? Basically.
We do indeed.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other fascinating one, of course, is the St. Peter's Stone at Wardlow Myers.
Yes.
You know about the guy that was gibbeted there.
Yes.
Anthony Lingard, hanged in front of Derby Jail in 1818, hung up at Wardlow Myers until 1826 before they took him down. Incredible story. I tell you, there's some... bloody good stuff, isn't there? Some good history.
Absolutely.
There really is.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that leads us into a subject that I was delighted you mentioned when I was arranging this interview, Richard, which was something that we clearly have a mutual love of, which is our wonderful history of Screaming Skulls, because probably two of the most famous, one's in Derbyshire and one's in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
So we'll start with the Derbyshire one, wonderfully
Dickie
named Dickie.
Dickie O'Tunstead.
Absolutely. Yeah. So tell us all about Dickie.
Well, Dickie apparently in the 1600s was a soldier that fought, I believe, in Flanders, something like that, and came home, as you do, well, those that live come home, and I believe, legend has it anyway, that his cousin or somebody had taken over the house or the farmhouse. What happened, I don't know what happened then, whether Dickie was killed, murdered, or what, but... Part of his skull, only a small part of his skull, by the way. There is actually a postcard with a picture of Dickie's skull, but it really is. It's actually on a windowsill.
Yes.
Inside the farm, and it's just the cranium. It's just the top part. But whenever it was taken out, because whoever would buy the farm or whatever over the years, you know, really don't want that in the house, you know, get rid of it, chuck it out, you know. And every time it left the house, screams were heard, and B, misfortune fell upon the family. That's the best way of putting it. You know, someone threw... I think it was Dickie's skull that was thrown into a lake, as well as everything else, and the fish died in the lake. and so they fished it out and brought it back in, and then someone else... And then the crops failed, and it's an omen of death and misfortune, as most of these... Most of these... Now, funnily enough, I'm trying to think where it was. On Most Haunted, I went up to one of the famous stately homes in Yorkshire. Can't remember. I'm trying to think. And they'd actually got Dickie O'Tunstead's bed on display.
Wow.
A four-poster bed. And you see, I'm a great believer in myths and legends. And what I'm saying is there's usually no smoke without fire.
Yes.
There's grains of truth in most myths and legends. They get changed, they get Chinese whispers.
Yes.
They become exaggerated beyond belief over the years of grandma telling the kids and that sort of stuff. But there's usually some basis of truth right back years ago. So, you know, if they say it was Ikea Tunston's bed, then why shouldn't it be, is what I'm saying. But what that's got to do with his skull? No, it hasn't. It's just another fascinating bit of it. You know, his actual bed is still... Why it isn't at Tunston Farm, I don't know. And, you know, I've never been.
Yes.
I have never actually been, unfortunately. And I presume the other one you're going to mention is Bert and Agnes, is it?
Absolutely, in Driffield, yes.
Ode Nance.
Absolutely, bless her.
Yeah, Anne Griffith. Yeah, that's again a fascinating story. She was attacked by robbers, apparently, beaten to death, and then told her sisters, I think, that she would never rest in her grave or something, unless a part of her remained at the hall. Yeah, okay, I don't know how true that is or not. But they didn't, did they? They took the whole of her and buried her.
Yes.
I think. And then after a burial, they were woken, or the sisters were woken by banging and slamming of doors and all manner of things like that. And I think took advice from the local vicar. Yeah. And they opened up the grave to find that the body was intact, but there was no head. I don't know. And so they took it into, or the head was found in the hall, but it's still there, isn't it?
Yeah, apparently it's one of those classic stories, Richard, where I think the origin's a little bit sort of murky now, we're not really sure, but it's the only, as far as I'm aware, you may know better than I, but as far as I'm aware, it's the only one of these alleged screaming skulls that's actually available to be visited, though you can't see the skull, because I think they built it into one of the walls to protect it.
That's correct,
throwing it away, because once again you had that, somebody buys a new property and they're like, why on earth have I got a skull here? So I think they just walled it up out the way so that wouldn't happen again. So as far as I'm aware, it's the only one that, although you can't actually see it, it's the only venue you can visit.
There are others, trust me, there are others.
Good.
Yes, there are. You see, I went to Bert and Agnes because obviously when I was doing Ghosts of Yorkshire on DVD, on sale on my website, but we couldn't go in, which was a real shame. Even, you know, I thought, even if we could just film where the wall is, where it's bricked up, but no, they wouldn't. I don't know whether it's open to... Is it open to the public now?
Well, I was actually over in Driffield earlier this week, and we were going to try...
Oh, right.
We were going to try and pop in, because it had reopened to the public.
Right.
Now, I'm not sure about the house, but the gardens certainly were, but...
Yeah, well, we did that.
Yeah. I'm going to be over there
next... In the garden.
Yeah, next year.
Oh, check.
So I'm going to hopefully find out, because we decided not to bother because we couldn't get into the house, obviously, in current circumstances.
What a TV programme it would make.
Yeah, absolutely. Very much so.
It's fascinating. I mean, the amazing thing is that the whole damn thing is peculiar to England.
Yes.
There's, as far as I know, and I hope someone out there can perhaps correct me, no England, Scotland, Ireland that I know of, it seems to be very, very English, and goes back to Celtic times. I mean, there's a thing here that I've got. It says that they cut off the heads of enemies slain in battle, embalm the heads in cedar oil, and preserve them carefully in a chest, and display them with pride to strangers. So, in other words, they got this idea which I think, I don't know whether this is right or not, that everything that is us is the head.
Yes.
The brain. Which I'm not so sure about, but if we get time, we'll discuss that in a few minutes.
Yeah.
But, it was believed that the head was all important. You know what I mean? That's where your personality, your ego, your consciousness, your brain. And so cutting off the head of another warrior and keeping it, they believe that part of the energy or whatever it was from that warrior could pass on to them.
Yeah.
And they sort of rode around with them on their saddles, and then eventually took them home, stored them in chests, and displayed them. But listen, it's no different to what we do with animals that we've shot on safari.
Yes.
They, which I'm very glad to say is stopped. I hope completely. But you know, foxes' heads, foxes' tails, displayed. But in Celtic times and probably beyond. the heads of your enemies were also displayed.
Yeah.
And you'd be having a big, a banquet or whatever, and the heads would be displayed, and you'd say, "This is the head of whoever it was. You know, I beat him in battle. Mm. Here's his skull to prove it." and then they also stuck them in places to ward off evil.
Mm.
At the ends of the beam, above the door, and one of the fascinating things is that whenever you go past somebody's gates and you see two balls on the gateposts, they're actually left over from the days when they used to put human skulls on the sides of the gates.
Oh.
Yeah, that's where it comes from. So if you've got a couple of balls, which I just happen to have as I'm looking out my window under my gate, there's two round balls that look like cannibals on there. But that actually originally was human heads.
Well, I never knew that, Richard.
Yeah, now then. Quite fascinating, that. But back to what you were saying about no others on display.
Mm.
We have one in Derby, of course.
Yes.
Which is a Viking skull.
Ah.
In a pub called, well, it was originally the George, it was a coaching inn.
Mm.
And that caused all manner of... I was around when it was found, dug out from under the ground when the builders were in. It's caused a phenomenal amount of poltergeist activity and things going on. If it leaves the building, things are supposed to happen.
Yeah.
But there's one at Affetside in Cumbria.
Yes.
And it's the skull of the executioner of the Earl of Derby.
Oh.
Who was... executed, beheaded after the end of the English Civil War, and somehow, I can't, no idea why, but after his executioner had beheaded him, years later he died. He was a farmer, I think, and for some reason his head is still on display in the pub. I did a TV programme for Canadian TV about that, and they wanted to take it out, and they wouldn't let us. No, things happen if you take it out. No, you can film it inside, you cannot take it outside. They were adamant about it.
Yeah.
And then I've just found another one in Launceston in Cornwall.
Ah.
Which is actually in Launceston's museum in a glass case.
Right.
Screaming skull.
Yep.
And it's the skull of a Cromwellian soldier.
Ah.
That for some reason, I think, I don't know what happened, but the local manor house or whatever was laid siege to, I believe, was obviously Royalist, and the Cromwellian troops were... And whatever happened, I don't know, but one of the Cromwellian soldiers was killed, and the lord of the manor, I believe, chopped off the bloke's head and kept his skull.
Yeah.
As you do. Same thing, that, you know, going back to Celtic times.
Yeah.
But here's an interesting bit. I hate to sort of spoil things, but this skull was actually in the house for many, many years and was then taken outside because they didn't want it and put it in the barn. And they believe that the reason that it screamed was, I've not tried it, I must do this, but I haven't done it yet, was because of the wind howling howling through the barn,
yeah,
with open doors or windows, and I believe going through the eye holes or the nose holes or something, and causing a screaming sensation, which is might be, again, you know, I hate to destroy it all, but that could be the origins of screaming skulls.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of my favourite ones, primarily because it involves one of my favourite ever comedians, Richard, is Theophilus Broom.
In Somerset.
In Chilton Farm. Yeah. Hi, Chilton Farm.
Chilton Cantello.
Absolutely.
Chilton Cantello.
Now, that's one
so
of the most...
So what's it got to do with it? What's it got to do with a comedian? I don't know this.
So the legendary Irish comedian Dave Allen loved ghost stories.
Oh, I loved it.
And he famously only ever spoke about this once. He was doing a show about ghosts in Britain
and
Ireland.
Didn't know this.
And he went to the actual farm to visit them and spent the day there and spoke to them about the history of the skull and everything. Because he, I believe, Broom, was a cavalier. And the reason he had his head removed was he didn't want his body digging up I think, by Cromwellians to have his head, because apparently they used to like decapitating them. So when he told his son, when I die, please take my head because I don't want my enemies to get it. So I think that's how his head ended up getting in the farm, as far as I'm aware, Richard. So obviously Alan had a massive love of the paranormal. And he went
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he adored
it. I've learned
it.
Something today. I've learned something.
And he went, did this show and everything, and... So he did it, had a great time, and apparently on his way home, an incident occurred that he wouldn't explain why. However, he rang them the day after and said he would never set foot on that farm again, and as far as he was concerned, they could keep it.
Good Lord. Wow, I like it. I'm going to have to look that up, because I'm very fond. I thought Dave Allen was fabulous.
Yes, wonderful.
I heard a lot from him, but I didn't know he was into ghosts.
Yeah, he adored him. Somebody's recently collated a collection, Richard, of his, of some of his... Because he used to do occasionally on his show or when he did stand-up live, he would finish the show with a ghost story.
Well, I've mimicked him, funnily enough, doing similar.
Yeah.
With a microphone. And how... Well. That's very interesting. I must look that up.
Yeah. I've got a link somewhere, so I'll add that to the golf club in Derby for you. You can have a look at it. But
Do that.
A collection of about 20 of his ghost stories at the end of his sets. So.
Oh, fantastic.
So hopefully you'll enjoy that as much as I did, sir.
Yeah, do right, I will. Yeah. Well, I never did. But, I mean, what an incredible... You know, there's at least... Gosh, I mean, I don't know. In my book, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7... I've got about 8 that I've covered in the book. Mm. But I learn about more. Mm. And I reckon there must be, I don't know, 12, 15... Mm. Screaming skulls, just in England. Well, only in England, as far as I know.
Yes, that is
but
the peculiarity.
Why England? What's... I don't know.
It is very peculiar.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's one of those little quaint quirks we have from... my cousin redeveloped an old church near Harrogate for his home. And it's the first time I've ever come across a real life example of this. They had one of those little boots hidden in the chimney breast. From a child, and it was the first. He's kept it, and he's got it on display because obviously he's aware of the providence of it, Richard. But to actually see one and hold one from a family member, it was incredible because they're the kind of things you hear about, but very rarely does something like that occur to you in your own family. And I just always found little things, you know, like witch marks and things like that, and incredibly fascinating.
Yes, while we're on the subject of witch marks, apotropaic marks, as they're called.
Yes.
I've only, the last few, just before lockdown, I got a phone call from a guy who I knew many, many years ago. He was a history teacher in Derby, and we had dealings over the years with things, and he'd been to a place called Creswell Crags.
Yes, I was there at Christmas.
Oh, you're kidding, aren't you? Really?
I went for the Krampus. They did a Krampus special party at Christmas, so I've been inside the caves there. But anyway, carry on, sir.
And did you see the witch marks?
I did indeed. It's fabulous.
Did they? Yeah, I know. And they go back a long time. Well, I mean, witch marks is actually the wrong... They're called witch marks, but they're not, are they? They're basically... It's a mark to help you against evil, to ward off evil.
Mm.
On doorways, doorposts, windows, fireplaces, any aperture, opening, where evil... Ghosts, I suppose, really, is what they're looking for. Ghosts, evil can enter the building.
Yes.
Is what they were on about, isn't it? Mm. Anyway, this guy said he'd been to Creswell Crags and he'd read, blah, 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 read all about it. And he'd been down to London and he'd been to a London museum where they'd got some panels. I don't know what he meant. I still don't know what he meant. From a prison.
Ah.
And on the door, on the panels were apotropaic marks, witch marks. And so he said, can I come and have a look at Derby Jail? So I said, of course you can come down there tonight. And down we went. He says, it's going around with his torch, whatever, you know, shining up on the... He says, you've got a new tour here, Richard. You've got a Derby Jail door tour here with witch marks all over it. V,
yes.
Virgin of Virgins. JM, Jesus and Mary.
Yeah.
St. Andrew's Crosses. Soul tires. All put there by the prisoners. On the doors to ward off what I don't know what to ward off what witches, evil, ghosts, because they were terrified in these places. Yeah. They believed it. Of course they believed it all in those days. And I've also got gallows scratched on the doors with witch marks on them. I presume to protect them from going to hell.
Yeah.
I would think. I can't believe it. It's fascinating. So, yeah, we now just about to start the Derby Jail door tour with all the witch marks on it. Oh. But you see it a lot in old 16th, 17th century houses, timber-framed houses. Look round the doors, the windows, chimney, and you'll see these witch marks.
Yeah, anything where they could get in, I think, isn't it?
Anything where they could get in, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Well, I've taken
people
some pictures.
Weren't they?
When I went to Criswell, I took some pictures, so I'll send you them, Richard, and you can have a look and see if anything matches with what you've
brilliant.
Got.
I'd love to.
Because it's a fabulous little tour, because there are literally thousands of them. Thousands of them. It's fantastic. I recommend it highly. It's wonderful.
But these are almost not prehistoric, but are they prehistoric?
They're not sure. There's a lot going on there because they found some fossils from 30,000 years ago, and there's evidence of life and people living in that area going back to the Ice Age. So it's clearly an area that's been used for a variety of reasons over millennia, Richard. Yeah. So there's a lot of history, and they're only just, because I think they only discovered these marks about 3 years ago. And they stumbled across them. They didn't know they were there till they were doing the whole area. It's fabulous.
No. You see, a lot of people, including me, put them down to initials.
Mm. No graffiti.
W, you see.
Yeah.
You think it's a William or a, you know, but it's not. It's VV, Virgin of Virgin, because there was no W.
Yes.
Yeah. There was no J either. Mm. It looked like an I. But honestly, what a subject.
Yeah.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Absolutely,
There's so much more to this than we realise.
It is, and I think it's something we're only just coming to terms with as well, Richard, like you say, because I think a lot of people have misidentified them for a long time, because it's not something I was very much aware of until, obviously, because it's 10 miles from where I live, and I'm, as you can tell, I like my weird
things. Is that all? Oh, yeah. Really? Oh, you lucky thing.
Yeah, because Worksop's 10 miles from Sheffield, so it's not far at all.
I used to be in the Territorial Army at Worksop.
Ah, well, there you are, then. You've got an excuse to go back, Richard.
Long time ago, but yeah, I did. Luminae. I say. So there's more to this witch mark thing than we realise, I think.
Yeah, very much so. Absolutely.
Wow. Oh, I say. I need to go into it.
Absolutely. Well, I'll definitely send you the pictures. I took several, so hopefully that'll be something of interest for you, Richard. I'll be more than happy to send
you. Very, very much so. Very much so. I presume there were probably were there any like these things called daisy wheels and things like that?
Yeah, there was. All kinds of designs, and like you say, there was initials and crosses and symbols and different designs.
I must go.
There's literally hundreds and thousands of them, Richard. They are everywhere.
Really?
Yeah, it's incredible.
And they were all frightened of ghosts, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, when you go there, I mean, we went at night. We went actually winter solstice. We went.
Oh, really?
And they'd done like a Krampus event, so they'd got some Krampus hiding inside the caves that you had to go and visit. So as part of it, we got some roasted chestnuts, and we were invited to do some axe throwing, and we went to meet the Krampi inside their cave and got some sweets off them for being good.
that sounds I must do that. Winter solstice, that sounds really good. Didn't know about it.
Yeah.
See, I've learnt a lot tonight.
Oh. So, I mean, for you, Richard, as well, because you've continued this love of haunted places and everything, and I know you mentioned it in regards to your tours, but you essentially went round the UK trying to collate areas and counties and do their history. So do you want to talk a little bit about that project you did?
I'm still at it. I haven't finished, but I don't know how many years ago now, 15 years, probably more. I decided that it'd be a good idea to do a DVD of Ghosts of Derby, and it sold like mad. And then me and the guy that did it, filmed it, edited it, did a lot. Said, why just Derby? So off we went to Bosworth Battlefield, and we started there and did Ghosts of Leicestershire.
Yeah.
Then we did, we've done Derby, we've done Ghosts of Derbyshire.
Yeah.
And I've ended up doing, 50 counties. Are the 50 counties? I'm not sure. Leicestershire, Lincolnshire, Derbyshire, Nottinghamshire. Oh, God. Hampshire, Cornwall, Devon, Somerset, all over. Scotland, Northern Ireland, South Wales, North Wales. So I've done over 50 DVDs of on the Ghost Tour of Great Britain.
Mm.
doing probably at least 12 different locations in each one.
Mm.
And it was tremendous. But like I say, I haven't done one for 10 years.
Mm.
Silly reason. The last one I did was Devon. No, that's not true, actually. I did another one called Ghost Cars.
Mm.
A haunted car that's down in Eastbourne. A Ford Capri. A Ford Capri. No, number plate, ARK, A-R-K 666. Notoriously haunted.
Mm.
Insurance companies wouldn't insure it anymore. Really good. I drove it and... Oh, it's quite good. It was quite something. But before that, Ghost of Devon was the last county I did. But I've got more to do,
yeah.
I'm afraid.
Well, I think you should. They were thoroughly enjoyable, right. Richard. I really enjoyed seeing them. It's good.
Well, they're different. Mm. And again, they're not meant to be scary, you see. They're just a bit like Strange But True, isn't it?
Mm.
Or Great British Ghosts.
Yeah.
Stories. I'm a storyteller.
Absolutely.
Amongst other things. Yeah. And yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed doing it. But, you know, I really... We've actually just put them... Because obviously the DVD game is nearly over.
Mm.
And we've created a thing called Netflix, which is downloads, you know.
Yes.
You go on to netflix.co.uk, I think it is, and you can download them. But the other thing we're looking at the moment, which is probably even better, is creating a box set.
Yes.
Like, for instance, we've got York and Yorkshire.
Mm.
Ghosts of the East Midlands, Ghosts of the North West, Ghosts of the South West, and putting them onto, what do you call it, like a fire stick?
Yes.
Where you could plug it into the back of the TV, all right? That's something we're working on now as well, which is a bit more modern than buying a DVD, because I think that, I believe they're actually, most places are stopping selling DVD players now.
Yeah.
Because it's all downloads, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
But, well, people still like to own it, though, don't they?
Mm.
To handle it. It's a bit like records.
Absolutely.
People still like to hold it and have the cover and read. That's the difference, I think.
Yeah.
Whereas downloading, it's not the same, is it?
No, absolutely. I mean, I've got a Kindle, but I still buy too many books.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you.
Because essentially I bought a Kindle because I wanted to save my luggage space when I went on holiday, Richard. That's the only reason I bought a Kindle.
Yeah, I understand that.
Because
it's not the same, is it?
No, because if I go away, I'm one of those people, I'll lay by a pool and read for 2 weeks. So I used to take three or four books.
Me too.
And some of these ghost books, yeah, absolutely. Some of these books are heavy tomes, especially some of the classic ghost stories, because there's nothing better than taking a nice collection of ghost stories away with you to dive into.
I know. It's fantastic, isn't it? It's absolutely fantastic.
Absolutely. So what else have you been up to then, Richard? What's been pulling
you? At the moment,
yes.
I've been writing I am writing, actually. I'm redoing a book called Derby, the Crossroads of History, which is the history of the famous people to do with Derby.
Mm.
I've been, for the last 3 years, for some ridiculous reason, I've been writing Ghosts of Greater Manchester, which still isn't finished. But the big one I'm doing at the moment, we came up with this idea a few weeks before lockdown, was creating a book by you, the people, called The People's Ghost Stories. And that's why at the beginning of our little interview here, you mentioned that you lived in a haunted house.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where your fascination came from. So I presume that you've got ghost stories about where you lived.
Yes, we had some very unusual ones, Richard. Very unusual. We had
you need to get it over to me.
I certainly will. One of my favourite... Well, the one that always... We had a certain little nuances with our house, essentially because it was a converted vicarage from the 18th century,
right.
Richard. And
one
of its favourite tricks was that it used to like to make the toilet flush.
Yes.
And it was an old pull flush as well.
Right.
So, and it would do it.
Pull the chain.
Yeah, and it would constantly do it. So when you heard the toilet flush, you knew we were going to have some fun that night.
You knew the ghost was in residence.
Absolutely.
Really? Yeah. Please, will you send it over to me?
Yeah, of course I will.
We're doing this book. Because basically, my knowledge, if you want to call it that, has come from talking to people. From talking to people, like I've learned stuff tonight from you. And this happens to me, well, apart from lockdown, all the time. Every time I'm out doing an event, I'm talking to people.
Mm.
And they give me their accounts, their stories. And so I thought what a fantastic idea it would be to create a book of Joe Public's ghost stories.
Yeah.
Not written by Edgar Allan Poe or, you know, someone with a fascinating imagination that creates ghost stories. Real ghost stories from ordinary people.
Mm.
And that's what we've done. That's what we're creating. And that's what we've been doing for the last 20 weeks, editing it. Mm. That's wrong. Not really editing it, but sort of a little bit changing stuff. When I say changing stuff, they send me the email, and then we get, "Hi, Richard, great to hear from you. I saw you on so-and-so last time on so-and-so, and we met." No, I don't want that, so I have to chop all that out and just put their ghost story in. You see where I'm coming from?
Yes.
You know? And then the other ones, we tend to go, and we've had a few of these. You know, "Hi, I'm so-and-so, so-and-so, and I'm a member of so-and-so paranormal, and with me is Fred, John, Pete, Tim, John, and so-and-so, and we run the paranormal, and our email address is so-and-so, so-and-so, and we do ghost of it," and then they start to tell me the ghost story when they were on a paranormal line. Well, that's all got to go.
Yeah.
So we've been editing it, you know what I mean? But some of the stuff's fascinating. Some of it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And the real proof behind it is how similar some of them are.
Mm.
But one is a lady of 80-something in Scotland, and the other one is a person of 23 in Basingstoke.
Yeah.
And they've never met, but their accounts are so similar.
Mm.
That's the proof that I believe is what it's all about.
Yeah.
Well, I've got it in front of me here now, you know, it's Christ knows how many pages. And story's the wrong word. It's account.
Yes.
They're not stories, they're accounts.
Mm.
And I think that's the big difference.
Mm.
And honestly, some of it is quite riveting.
Yeah.
In the way. What we're doing now is putting pictures to it, because obviously a lot of people haven't put pictures.
Yeah.
So all we're now doing at this moment is, right, you know, I worked for 4 years in the such and Saracen's Head in York, blah, 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 blah. So we're going to have to put a picture of the character Saracen's Head in, you know what I mean? That sort of stuff to make it, because I'm a great believer in pictures.
Yes.
As well. So, you know, it needs pictures, and a lot of people haven't sent pictures. Some of them have, some of them quite good, some of them, you know, the picture of the ghost that they've seen and stuff like that.
Mm.
But it's very different. No, I don't, as far as I know, nobody has ever created a book like it.
Mm.
People's ghost stories.
Yeah. Do you think that's helped because you've got a reputation of treating people fairly, Richard, without any kind of dismissal of that? And essentially, and the thing I've often found when I've spoken with people with similar experiences is that, not that I'm being dismissive, but that your average ghost story is quite banal. It's nothing terrifying. It's nothing.
No, it isn't.
It's just something that occasionally happens, or a weird little trick that they have.
And you actually stayed in the bed.
Yeah.
Even though for 12 minutes that figure stood at the foot of your bed or stood at the side of you. Yes, you stayed there. Yes, I pulled the covers over. You stayed in the bedroom. Yes, I did. That sort of stuff. You know, I mean, it's just. It's fascinating.
Mm.
The whole damn thing is fascinating. And this is what's in this book.
Yeah.
You know, some of them are short stories.
Mm.
Some of them are much longer stories.
Mm.
But on the whole, it's quite... That's why I want your story. I want to know, if you will, please, send me your story through of where you lived in and what happened, because it sounds good. Sounds a good one.
Absolutely. I'd be delighted
I'd like
to.
It.
No problems at all.
If you can, because we've got a couple of weeks, before we finish it.
Absolutely.
So get them over to me.
I'll be delighted to.
Just finish this, get on to it.
I've always found it quite sweet, Richard, when you speak to people who seem to become very accustomed to their ghosts and seem to have a real affection towards their haunting.
Yes, correct. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I wish this was in it, and it isn't, because I can't remember who she was, but I had an account from a lady years ago. She'd written a book called Don't Call Them Ghosts, and she believed that she had children that occupied her attic that she used to take Christmas presents up to and leave them in the attic at Christmas. I mean, wow.
Oh, that's lovely, that.
Incredible. Incredible, yeah. I mean, I spoke to her on the phone years ago. As we speak, I'm only just remembering it, actually. And she genuinely believed that the ghosts of these children were still in her attic, and she treated them as members of the family.
Hmm. Aww.
Incredible. And she was the most down-to-earth ordinary person.
Mm.
She wasn't a nutcase or crackpot, as far as I know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, that's what it's about. People live with them.
Mm.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
They live with them, they give them nicknames. Oh, I came in and go, Fred's been banging around again upstairs.
You know? Yeah, Fred's always a very popular name for some reason, Richard.
Isn't it? Yeah. but I tell you, you know, it's part of the family.
Mm.
Part of the house.
Absolutely. I tend to enjoy sometimes just going on YouTube and trying to find some really old ghost documentaries, and I stumbled across one from the 1980s that was on BBC. And there was a very interesting story about a chap whose auntie had died. He had twin aunties, and he was very close to them both. He thought they were lovely, and he lived in Todmorden in West Yorkshire. And he was driving with his wife through the town centre, and as he was driving, he saw his former auntie, but he was that surprised he didn't realise that he was looking at someone that had passed away. And it was only when he said to his wife, "Oh my goodness, there's Auntie Annie," she went, "Well, it can't possibly be Auntie Annie, because Auntie Annie's been dead 2 years." And he suddenly thought, "Well, that means my Auntie Edna, there must be something wrong." So he went round to his other auntie's house, and she'd fallen in the night and broken her hip, and she'd managed to crawl into the chair, and she couldn't get to the telephone to call anybody. And it was only because he'd seen the ghost of her sister that made him go round to see her. It saved her life.
Yeah, I know. There you are. It's incredible, isn't it? Hey? Incredible. Do you know what? While I'm talking to you, I've actually just looked up this, and the book's there. Don't Call Them Ghosts.
Mm.
The Spirit Children of Fontaine's Manse, a True Story paperback. In 1971, the author and her family moved into a historic home known as Fontaine Manse. 2 days after moving in, she and her husband had an extraordinary experience that left them with no doubt that unseen residents occupied the house. Incredible. I'm going to get that. I'm going to order that quick.
Yeah. Fantastic. Fantastic.
It is. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, boy. I tell you, so much more to this business than people realise.
Yeah.
And we can get away from the silly scare factor all the time.
I've mentioned it several times on this show because, like I say, I'm a massive fan of what Peter Underwood used to do, and John and Anne Spencer as well,
absolutely.
Richard. And I think we seem to have gone away from those wonderful collections of stories like the one you're collating at the moment. And I look forward to that, because they're usually the most compelling ones. You know, I get so tired of people saying, "Oh, the demons are in my house," or "I try to be possessed," and it's like, really?
Bloody demons. I know. Bloody demons. No such thing. Made up by the church, but that's another story, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Keep you in control, sir.
Oh, boy. Yes, absolutely.
So other than that, then, so you're working on this book. What else? Anything else?
Anything else? Well, that's a good question. Oh, dear. Well, I created two virtual ghost walks.
Mm.
A virtual ghost walk of York.
Yeah.
For people, obviously, while they were on lockdown. And a virtual ghost tour of Derby.
Yeah.
On lockdown, which people can, you know, they book up. I can't remember. I can't tell them how to do it. But if you look it up, it's there on the internet. And people have been using it, but, you know, it's not quite the same as going around with someone, though, is it, and being scared to death. Something jumping out at you as you're going around. We can't do that. And what else? That's it. And to be honest with you, other than that, I've been working at home doing stuff, repairing and decorating and gardening and all sorts of stuff like that. You know, playing at being retired, which was lovely.
Nothing wrong with that. I mean, I must take a trip. Derby's somewhere I've not really visited a lot, Richard, to my shame. So I must pop down and pay you a visit at some point.
Come and have a look. Come on and go sport with me one night.
Oh, I'd be delighted to. Delighted to join you. I think it's one of those things that, like you say, once again, the ghosts will often open people's eyes to the actual history of where they live.
Correct. Yes. So true.
Yeah, very much so. So before I let you leave, Richard, is there one ghost that you think we need to be aware of who comes from Derby that perhaps isn't well known, or your favourite ghost from Derby?
Oh, my favourite ghost has to be the ghost of PC Joseph Moss, who was a policeman, the only policeman ever murdered in Derbyshire, and the only policeman ever shot and murdered in a police station on mainland Britain.
Wow.
Today, who was murdered in Derby lockup on July the 12th, 1879.
Mm-hmm.
Shot in the police station. by a drunk who'd got a loaded revolver in his pocket, and nobody searched him when they brought him in. And he shot the youngest policeman, Joseph Moss, was 26, ex-Grenadier Guardsman, and shot another policeman in the arm who committed suicide 12 years later by throwing himself out of his bedroom window. And the fascinating story is that when the murderer, who was a gentleman from a place called Whitmore Hall in Staffordshire, the jury, because the guy was drunk and a gentleman, it was a hung jury. Six for murder and six for manslaughter. So after hours of deliberation, they decided the only way to decide his fate was to draw lots. Short straw. And the guy that had the short straw said murder. And so the death sentence was passed on him. But the local Derby newspaper, which had only been going for 1 week, somehow managed to get an interview with one of the jurors who spilled the beans. And the Home Secretary was sent to Derby to investigate and had no option other than to commit the hanging. And the murderer only spent 14 years in prison and went off to Manitoba. Joseph Moss's ghost for years has haunted the site of Derby lockup, which for many years after they knocked the lockup down was warehousing for Derby Market Hall, and also then became Derby Fish Market. And the number of sightings of this policeman with a moustache with twisted ends, well, I've got a photograph of him as well, so it's absolutely right, genuine, have been seen. And obviously on every ghost walk I ever did, this story, which I, you know, went much longer than what I've just told you, went out, and eventually I had a group of policemen on the ghost walk who didn't know anything about it, which is typical, you know, don't teach local history. So they helped me raise £4,000, to put a plaque on the site where the murder took place. And the following year, we restored his grave, which I found in the cemetery in Derby, trashed. Collapsed, all fallen to pieces, the letters fallen off it, plant pots on top of it. And so, the following year, and we had the murderer's family, the murderer's family there. We had P.C. Moss's great-nephew, the trumpeters from the Grenadier Guards playing the last post. The whole work. And then the following year, same thing happened again when we put up a new gravestone. With a Grenadier Guards badge on it and Derbyshire Constabulary on it, and everybody came again. And guess what? Nobody's seen the ghost since. There's a phrase called laid to rest.
Yes.
Yeah, incredible. And I now have his old gravestone on display in Derby Jail. Belting story.
Clearly,
that would make a book.
Not at all. Clearly you appreciated everything you'd done for him, Richard.
Looks like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's the other word, you see, respect.
Yes.
Respect. Have it for them. They were you and me once.
Yeah, absolutely. I've done I spoke to an author, a delightful gentleman. I've done a couple of shows with him called Andy Gilbert. And he was a former police officer, and he's done two collections of first-hand reports from serving and former police officers up and down the UK, all about their paranormal encounters. And I'm surprised that didn't make it in. Yeah.
That's an interesting one.
Yeah, two brilliant little books. Really, really good collections. Yeah. And there's some very strange ones. There's a couple quite local. There's a couple from Nottingham, and there's a couple from Derbyshire in general. So I'll give you the heads up on that one as well. I'll be sending you a very big email, Richard, later.
Your ghost stories on it.
Absolutely. Right. Well, listen, Richard, thank you so much for your time this evening. Where can everybody keep up to date with your work and find out what you're doing next?
My website, richardfelix.co.uk.
Lovely.
richardfelix.co.uk. And all that's all my ghost walks. But if you just put ghost walks and things in, that comes up anyway, Derby ghost walks. But and then if anybody wants to get in touch with me, I'd love their stories or anything else anybody's got. richardfelix@gmx.com. richardfelix@gmx.com.
I will put links to both in my show notes, so if anybody wants to check him out or send you an email, Richard, they can do. And all I will say is thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. I've been looking forward to speaking to you for a very long time, so thank you for your time.
I've enjoyed it. It's been great.